the first Christian church in Philippi. In fact, we could almost be sure in saying this, they formed the first Christian church in Europe. There is the possibility, of course, that there was a church commenced in Rome before this, but you couldn't prove it. You see, there was no apostle went to Rome to start the church. Peter never was there at that time. In fact, it's doubtful if Peter ever was in Rome. I told some folks on one occasion when they were trying to argue about it, I said, look, there is just as much historical evidence that Paul preached on the site of St. Paul's Cathedral in Ludgate Hill in London as there is that Peter ever preached in Rome. There's no historical evidence he ever was there, but there was a church in Rome. There's no record of how it started, but since Paul wrote to them, sent a letter to them and mentioned the names of certain people who were there that he knew, it has been concluded that that was commenced by people whom Paul had contacted in other cities, perhaps in Jerusalem and elsewhere. And when they went back to Rome, their hometown, they gravitated together and commenced the church there. Other than that, Philippi was the place where Paul and his companions first went when they received a Macedonian call and they came over from Asia Minor and came over into Europe. This was where they started their work, in Philippi. And as a result of their labors in Philippi, people were converted, gravitated together, and so there was established the Christian church in Philippi. And Paul here is lying in the prison at Rome now, and he's sending them a letter. You will remember what I said, why he was sending this letter. It was a letter of thanksgiving from Paul the prisoner who had been a preacher. Well, that doesn't mean he stopped preaching because he was a prisoner. He kept preaching in the prison. But now he's a prisoner because of his testimony. And he's sending back this letter of thanksgiving to those people in Philippi. I also mentioned that as you go down through this epistle, he strikes the note of joy again and again. He seems to rise to a high crescendo of joy. And you begin to question these things. How could a man be so joyful lying in prison? Well, he wasn't joyful because he was in prison. He was joyful in spite of the fact that he was in prison. You see, his joy did not depend on circumstances. His joy was something that was deep-rooted. It was because of a relationship he had with his God. You and I, you know, sometimes we have a lot of joy when everything is going well with us. Everything is going our way. We're getting all the material things we need. Everybody's being kind to us. And so it makes us very joyful. But when the coin flips over, things begin to go against us. Sometimes joy flies out the window. And then we've got to bring ourselves again to the point where we've got even to chastise our own souls for allowing ourselves to forget that our joy is in the Lord. However, we got down to the end of verse 6 where he said, being confident of this very thing, that he which has begun a good work in you will perform it until the day of Jesus Christ. There was a note of confidence. He wasn't there to help those people, although he's writing to them, but he said this. It was the Lord who commenced the work with you, and if the Lord commenced to work with you, I know this. If he has begun that good work in you, God cannot fail. He will perform it until the day of Jesus Christ. You know, sometimes we lose our grip on this great truth. And we think that some things depend on what we do and how we do it. If we would learn this, that we're just co-partners or co-workers with Him, it's God who takes the responsibility. Our business is just to be obedient and do the work the way He wants it done. I was reading a little this week along that particular line of things. It's not in this passage, of course, but just let me mention it to you. You've read often in the Bible about that man whose name was Cain. His name has been mentioned often from this desk. Myself, along with other preachers, have brought it up time and time again. Remember this. Cain was a religious man. Not only so, Cain never worshipped a false god. Cain was not an idolater. If you had spoken to Cain, he would say, oh yes, I believe in God the Creator, and I worship God the Creator. Oh yes, he believed in the right God. He believed in making sacrifice to God. He brought his sacrifice to the right place. He brought it at the right time. Now what was wrong? Simply this, he sought to worship God in his own way. And we can only offer true worship, acceptable worship to God, if it is offered in God's way. Let me go a little further. Aaron was the first high priest in Israel. He had four sons. And when the priesthood was inaugurated after the tabernacle was erected, two of the sons of Aaron went into the holy place. Well, they went to the right place, all right. Because in the holy place there was a cloud of Shekinah glory representing the presence of God. There was the glory of God. They went to the right place. And they carried with them their censers. That was the right thing to do. And they carried with them incense in their hands. That was the right thing to do. See, they were taking in the right thing, taking it in along with their censers, and going into the right place, and God, in judgment, struck them dead. You say, now, why? Why should God act with such severe judgment on these two men? Weren't they going into the right place? Yes. Weren't they going to do the right thing? Yes. Well, what was wrong? Very carefully watch this. They were supposed to take live coals from off the altar, the place of sacrifice. They were to take those live coals from off the altar where the sacrifice had been offered to God. On the strength of that sacrifice that had been consumed with the fire, they were to take the live coals in the censer, carry it in. Now, where did that fire come from? It came from God. It was fire from God that first of all lit the altar fire. They were supposed to take some of that, go in, put the incense on that, and the cloud of incense would rise and be accepted by God. But what did they do? They took what the Bible calls strange fire. Fire that did not come from God. Fire that was of man's manufacture. And they offered their incense on that, which was an insult to God. God acted in swift judgment. It's a blessing for us. We're living in the day of God's grace. Isn't it? Now I mention these things to you because when you come to this verse, he says, I am confident that he that has begun the good work in you will perform it until the day of Jesus Christ. God will perform his own work. Your responsibility and mine is to submit ourselves to what God has revealed. Not to introduce our ideas in order to push God's idea aside. When God makes his will known, it stays. He moves on from there, and he mentions in verse 7 a little note of appreciation. Just make a remark of it. Even as it is meet for me to think this of you all, because I have you in my heart, inasmuch as both in my bonds and in the defense and confirmation of the gospel, ye all are partakers of my grace. You know, it's a wonderful thing when a man like the great Apostle Paul, lying in prison, can write such a letter and strike this note of appreciation for these Christians away in Philippi. I wonder how often have you done something for somebody? Oh, you weren't obligated to do it, but you felt that it would be the right thing to do. You could help that person. You said, now let us do this, or let us do something else. And you decided what you would do, and you performed that little service for them. But time went on. There's no note of appreciation. They never even said thank you. They just took it all for granted. Never as much as said a thank you. You've had that experience, haven't you? Some of you may have done it for members of your own family. You may have done it for others who were related to you in other ways. You may have done kindnesses to people just because you knew them. And there's never been an expression of appreciation. And you said, well, that was the first time. That is the last. Why? Because lying somewhere in all our hearts, there is that which appreciates an expression of appreciation. Isn't it? It brings you a little happiness, a little joy. All right. The great Apostle Paul writing his letter, and he strikes this note of appreciation for what the Christians in Philippi have done for him. In my bonds, they didn't forget him when he was a prisoner. And when I stood in defense and confirmation of the gospel, why, ye were partakers of this with me. You were in fellowship with me. You did it once and again. You've never forgot me. And I'll tell you this, I believe, if you and I could have been present at some of the prayer meetings in the church at Philippi, I have every reason to believe that Paul was being mentioned in the prayers as they would pray to God on behalf of Paul. But you remember, it was Paul who came along and preached there. They heard the gospel from his lips. They believed the message. They were saved. And so their whole Christian life stems back to the time when Paul entered into that city. And now here he is. He's expressing his appreciation to them. They had expressed their appreciation for him when they sent along the things that Epaphroditus took from Philippi along to Rome. Paul expresses his appreciation for what they've done, and you see, they had been expressing their appreciation for what Paul had done for them. It's a good thing, beloved, when we can take time to express our appreciation. Now, he goes a little further. He expresses now something regarding his affection for them. For God is my record. Now, that word record is the same word as you find other places in the New Testament for witness. When he said to his disciples, ye shall be my witnesses, ye shall be my records. God is my witness. How greatly I long after you all in the bowels of Jesus Christ, in the affections of Jesus Christ. Now he says, God is my witness. Now you know, when a man goes into law courts today and he takes his place as a witness, he's going to give his witness. It used to be you had to place your hand on the Bible. I don't know if they do it like this now, but you had to place your hand on the Bible. And you had to raise your right hand up. And you had to say, I swear by Almighty God that I promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Now that was a very solemn thing. to place your hand on the Word of God, take an oath before God. I've heard men do that. In the next 2 minutes, they stood there in the witness box and told a whole parcel of lies. He said, you know, because I was there. Listen to them. And I knew what they were saying wasn't true. I knew the man who was being accused. I was in to hear another case, and his case came up. I went to him after. I said, Tom, why didn't you stop the case and challenge the statement of that man? He says, how could I have done it? I said, stop the case. Tell your lawyer, that's a lie. Let them go and measure the road. So that judge didn't know the road. You did, I did, and a lot of other people. I said, go and measure it. Well, he said, he claimed he measured it. I said, but you know where he measured it. He and I talked about it. He said, you're right. He got fined, guilty, because of a man who took an oath and told lies, standing in the witness box. Brothers and sisters, Paul here says, God is my witness. God is my record. In plain words, what I'm saying, God in high heaven knows it's true. He can read my heart. You see, it's not simply what comes from the lips that counts. It's what's resting down there in the heart. God knows our every thought. He knows exactly what we're thinking. Now, we can deceive one another, you know. Can't deceive God. Be not deceived. God is not mocked. God is my witness. What to? How greatly I longed after you all in the affections of Jesus Christ. He is a man who had a great affection for the Christians. Philippi. I've said this often to you, that when you try to think of the Christians as a family, God's family, and each one who has been born of the Spirit of God is able to say, our Father. And if we can all in truth say, our Father, then we're children of the same Father, members in the spiritual family, and if that's true, we should have at least some measure of affection for each one. You see, in the affections of Jesus Christ, I wonder, what kind of a love does he have for each of us? Does he show favoritism to any in the flock? Or does he look after the whole flock? Does he show favoritism to any in the family? Or does he love the whole family? Well, if he loves the whole family, so should we. Now, from that point then, you come to verses 9 through 11. And here, there is set before us one of the prayers of the Apostle Paul. This I pray, that your love may abound yet more and more in knowledge and in all judgment, that you may approve things that are excellent, that you may be sincere and without offense till the day of Christ, being filled with the fruits of righteousness which are by Jesus Christ unto the glory and praise of God. Now, might I say that a careful examination of this prayer will convince the exercised Christian that the life of the believer should be marked by continual and steady advancement in spiritual quality. You see, the day you were saved was only the commencement of your Christian life. And the consummation of your Christian life will be when the Lord calls us home, either in death or when he comes with trumpet sound and we're caught up to meet him in the air. Those years that lie in between have to be years of advancement. There's no standing still. And there's to be no going back. Going on. Let me use an illustration. When the children of Israel were in the wilderness, going from Egypt to Canaan, they were guided by that cloud. Pillar of cloud by day, pillar of fire by night. Now suppose some of them had said, that cloud isn't moving quick enough for us. I think we could move a lot quicker. What's the good of us waiting for these slow people there? Let's get ahead and get into the promised land. They would have been running before God, and they would have landed themselves in difficulties. But suppose some of them had said, no, I'm not going to keep up with that cloud. I'll find my own way to the promised land. I'm just going to rest here for a day or two. You can go on. What would have happened? They would either have lost the way, or they would have turned back and gone back towards Egypt. They were not supposed to stay when the cloud moved, and they were not supposed to run before the cloud. They were just to follow after as the cloud moved. That was the indication God was moving. But there was progress. Likewise, in the Christian life, there is to be advancement. There is to be progress in all spiritual qualities. Now, when a man or a woman gets saved, they tell you they've trusted the Lord. You don't expect them to know everything the first day they're saved. You and I didn't. In fact, we don't know it all yet, and we never will. We haven't got the capacity to take it all in. But we've learned, we've gone on. Your little boy or girl goes to school, and before they've got to school, there's perhaps three or four in the family that have gone before them. When one gets into the first grade, another one perhaps in the third grade, and one in the fifth grade, and one in high school, you know that. You don't expect the little one in the first grade to be able to do the same thing as the one in high school. But remember, the one in high school was once in first grade. And they graduate from one class to another, and they learn and learn and learn until when they come out of school, even yet they haven't learned at all. They have an awful lot of things to learn after they get out of school. But the point is this, there was progress. Now, there's one thing, according to this prayer, in which there's to be a process. It's the process of love's perfecting. This I pray, that your love may abound yet more and more. How can love abound more and more? He tells us, in knowledge and in all judgment. It would almost appear that Paul here strains the language, put a big strain on it, in order to emphasize the need for increasing love. Look at this statement. Abounding more and more. What does it mean to be abounding? If you had lived where I lived as a little boy, you might have seen something happen once or twice that was not supposed to happen, but it did. I've told you before, we had hills behind the town, and we used to climb those hills. But there were people who had sheep on those hills, grazing the sheep. And often, particularly on a Sunday, you'd find a lot of people up on the face of the hill. There was a little path went up, people would go up there and sit on the grass, or sit on some of the seats, and out in the sunshine when they had it, with that those kind of go up with some sunshine. Although I have been up when the snow was there, but it's dangerous. But I've seen us up there, and some boys who had come in as visitors. Seldom did local boys do it, because they knew better. But some boys who had come from the city, and they'd got the hill, they thought it'd be a wonderful thing to take one of the rocks, big boulders, and roll it down the hill. When they started that boulder going, it was rolling. All of a sudden, it would take a bound. And when it would strike again, it would bounce. And by the time you saw it coming down, mark you, they're way up about 1,000 feet, coming down those slopes. People would just cup their hands and shout, warn the people down below. You'd see that boulder coming down, and you're always wondering when a sheep was going to be killed. It was increasing in speed. And it was bounding and are bounding. And every time it bounced, it was greater and greater with a force. I've wondered, is that what Paul's got in mind? Abounding more and more in love. That your love's to be abounding, and there's two things attached to it, knowledge and judgment. What is knowledge? That's not simply an intellectual ability. Some folk think that knowledge means that you know a lot of things. Well, it may have that connotation, but not here. It's talking here of spiritual intelligence. Abounding more and more in knowledge. Spiritual intelligence. Not only so, there's to be discernment. That's the thought of judgment here. It's not a matter of coming down in judgment on someone. That's not the thought. It's like the man who has heard all the facts of the case, and he says, having listened to all the evidence, this is my judgment in the matter. He comes and he makes a decree on the strength of what he knows. Knowledge makes discernment possible. If you don't know, how can you decide? But discernment makes knowledge practical. See, if you know these things, then there's the judgment, there's the discernment. Now he said, that's what I want you to do. You see, the love that you read up in the Bible is not this silly, sentimental nonsense, slushy thing that you hear of today. Something far better is the love, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, and so on. Christ loved the church, gave himself for it. Paul says, the Son of God that loveth me, he gave himself for me. That same love is to be shed abroad in our hearts. That love is to be abounding more and more in knowledge, spiritual intelligence, and in discernment. That you may, what? Approve things that are excellent. That you may be sincere and without offense till the day of Jesus Christ. You see this to be the enlargement of love and the enrichment of love. But now what about the employment of love? You see, the growth of love in knowledge and discernment is with a view to action. Let there be a recognition of distinctions. How do you know that? That you may be sincere without offense, that you may approve things that are excellent. You see, there are things that have a difference. You to be able to approve the things that are excellent. Now let me speak freely to every one of you in here tonight. I don't know how you feel tonight or this week. But so far as I am concerned, these last 2 days I've been sick at the stomach. Strong language, but I mean it. Not because of anything I've been eating, but because of what I've been seeing and hearing. Who ever thought that we would have displayed to us in this so-called enlightened country crowds of people marching a street of one of the prominent cities of this land, displaying to people what they are, making a mockery of the standards of God, displaying to the world that they live in sin. It takes you back to Romans chapter 1, that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, but became vain in their imaginations, and God gave them over to a reprobate mind. And may I say this, frankly, to all of you tonight, don't let us put our teeth in it. These people were marching the streets, calling themselves gays and lesbians. The Bible condemns them as sinners. It's sin. And they're glorying in it. They're rolling it under the tongue like a sweet morsel. And one wonders just how long God will tolerate this before he comes down on them in judgment. We're to be able to distinguish between things that differ. That's sin. Let us approve the things that are excellent. Don't make excuses for these people. God condemns them. God condemns what they're doing. What they need to do is repent and get right with God. But you see, there's no thought of God before the man. Ah, but brothers and sisters, there are things that are excellent. There are still standards in this word that you can lay before your children. There are still standards we can lay before one another. And there are still excellent things for us in this life. Let us be able then to discern between the things that differ and approve the things that are excellent, being filled with the fruits of righteousness, which are by Jesus Christ. You see, what is righteousness?